Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's?
Hi, my name is Shane Theriault, and you are listening to The Riff Raff. Music, stories, and insights from the front line. Hello, and greetings from sunny Las Vegas, Nevada, where I have a day off. I'm on tour, summer tour, with Daryl Hall and John Oates. Am I out gambling, doing fun Las Vegas type things? No. I'm in my hotel room, finishing this episode of Riff Raff to deliver to you. I've been getting a lot of comments. Keep it up, keep it up. We need more and more. Well, they take a lot of time, but, you know, it's a labor of love. So I'm glad you guys even listen. Thank you for your comments. If you haven't commented or give me a rating on iTunes, that's the only thing I ask. It's definitely gaining in popularity, so keeps me making more. Okay, enough of that. My guest today is bassist Mark Egan. He's a world-renowned bassist, composer, band leader. He's recorded and performed with many of the greats in the world of music. He was an original member of the Pat Metheny Group, the first incarnation of that band, which produced such classic records as American Garage. Mark's also recorded many of his own projects, his own solo records, with perhaps the best known of these being the band Elements, with drummer Danny Gottlieb, with whom to this day he still shares a close musical relationship, as you'll hear about. In this interview, we talk about early days at University of Miami, transitioning from trumpet to bass, studying and playing with Jaco Pastorius, getting his first fretless from Jaco, pretty cool story. Early gigs in New York, Pat Metheny, Dave Sanborn, Sting, Gil Evans, Duran Duran, list goes on. And get this, Bill Cosby. Yes, he actually did a jazz record, and it's actually really great. I had the pleasure of working with Mark a few months ago, recording for a few days for an upcoming project, and I can assure you he is definitely one of the greats, cool guy. He's worked with so many legendary guitar players as well. Pat Metheny, Pat Martino, Scofield, John Abercrombie, McLaughlin, you name it. So on this beautiful day, I took the train up from Manhattan to Mark's studio in Connecticut and missed the connection. Oops. But Mark was gracious enough to pick me up at a different train station and go out of his way. And we make it to his beautiful home and studio, and we are off and running. So step in, we're just sort of improvising on a little chordal progression, playing music, having fun, and it's my pleasure to bring you this episode of Riff Raff. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you. Seemed like a good place to stop.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, Mark. I am sitting here in Mark Egan's beautiful studio in Connecticut. Beautiful day.
Yeah.
And thanks for doing this, accommodating me.
Oh, thanks. Great that you could
stop by. And picking me up
at
the train station.
Yeah. Crazy trains. Yeah, I'm glad you could come by.
Yeah. Finally made it happen. It takes, sometimes it takes a little while to get things done. But
I know, yeah. I know. You've been traveling. I've been traveling. And
yeah. That's what happens. I'll tell the listeners, I first met Mark a couple of, I guess it's about 2 years ago now. We played together with a mutual friend, Steve Shapiro.
Yes.
Great vibes player.
We played up in, here in Connecticut.
Yes. That was fun. And of course, I knew who you were and history and everything. And it was, you know, a thrill to get to play. Even as strange as a gig as that was, I remember. But
it was trio. It was vibes, bass, and guitar.
Yeah.
And kind of a loud crowd. But
a
we,
loud crowd.
We
loud
slugged through it.
Crowd.
We had fun. Yeah. That was good. And then we did a couple other dates with Steve. At least one. Oh, no, two others.
Yeah, one recently at Richard Bona's club.
Yes.
Joel Rosenblatt.
Club Bonafide, yep. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, that was it was interesting because when we played at Club Bonafide, I had been working on this project with Arjun Brugman, who's a tabla player. He plays with Krishna Das, and we play together with Krishna Das. And I had been wanting to add acoustic to the project because so far, up to that point, it had been just tablas and bass. Mm-hmm. And then when we played that night, I said, Shane, you play acoustic, don't you? And then he said, yeah. And then day or two later, you were at the studio here.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, really, really nice combination.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Well, I mean, let's see where to start. I mean, you have such a huge discography and history and a lot of things you've done. I mean, I don't want to, like, get into every little bit of history, but...
Yep.
But, you know, I was... let's just start with... You're from Massachusetts originally, right?
Yes, I'm from Brockton, Massachusetts. It's on the South Shore. It's about 35 miles from Boston.
And then you went to Berkeley, right?
I went to the University of Miami.
Oh, you didn't go to... I knew you went... I thought you maybe went to Berkeley for a minute and then... But I know you definitely went to University of Miami because Will Lee and I were just... He just brought up your name when I interviewed him. He was talking about how Jocko was the teacher and you were there and...
Yes.
You know.
And Will, when I met Will at the University of Miami, his father was the dean of music.
Right.
Dean Lee.
Dean Lee. Sounds like a comic book.
Yeah.
Stan Lee.
And
let me move this suit.
Will was playing French horn and bass, but he was, when I knew him, he was a French horn player. And then we were in a small group as part of the school, and he played bass, and I was playing trumpet. So I originally went to Miami as a trumpet player.
Yeah, because you were a really accomplished trumpet player. I don't know if a lot of people know that. Like, you were doing gigs and stuff on
trumpet.
Yeah,
I was doing gigs since I was 15 around the Boston area. At that time, I played in a lot of rhythm and blues bands, playing the music of Wilson Pickett and James Brown, you know, with horn section, twirling horns. And so, you know, that was my roots around the South Boston area, which was kind of a rough scene. But I loved it because I was 15. And, you know, I would tell my parents that I was going to play at a Knights of Columbus Hall or something. If they only knew. They trusted me. And I have to say that they gave me so much support in my life to do whatever I wanted to do. But, you know, there's certain things you just couldn't tell your parents because they would have said no. So, but that's what... my early years was playing trumpet, actually, not only in R&B bands, but I played in jazz bands around Brockton, youth stage band, and we played at Montreal at the World's Fair, played with that band, and I was on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, which was a show at the Ed Sullivan Theater. So, you know, it's funny. Yeah, I remember going backstage there when we first got there. I was 16, and... We were in the same dressing room that the Beatles were in, and I thought that was such a big thing.
Well,
it was, you know.
Yeah, sure. At what point did you switch to bass? Teens or late
I was
teens?
In my teens. Actually, around the same time when I was about 15, 16, I was also interested in playing bass because I just heard, for some reason, my ears gravitated towards bass, because on the radio at the time, that was in the late 60s, mid to late 60s, music of Motown, Hendrix, Cream, all the great, you know, rock and soul and funk music was happening, and the bass was pretty predominant in a lot of those mixes. And for some reason, even though I was a trumpet player, which is more of the higher spectrum of things, I was tuning into the bass, and I actually went out and bought a bass, a cheap Delray bass, and I got a
Delray. I've never even heard of a Delray.
Yeah, it was a Japanese bass, very inexpensive.
Of course, with that name.
Cost $40. I remember I paid for it, and then I got a Supro bass amp, one of the originals, and I wish I still had it.
Now, where did Ira Sullivan come in? Were you still in school when you started playing with Ira Sullivan?
Yes, and Ira Sullivan lived in Florida. He originally from Chicago, and when I first went to Miami, he was playing with a group at a club called The Rancher, which was up in North Miami. We used to go to see him at late night, and it was a great. Joe DiOrio was playing with him. Steve Bagby, an amazing drummer. Tony Castellano, Billy Fry was the bass player, and just some of the most creative music, jazz music. And, you know, Ira still plays that. I didn't start to play with him, Ira, till maybe about 3 years when I was there, and I was playing upright. I played in a group playing upright with Ira.
Is that the group that, I'm not going to keep asking about Jaco the whole time, but I think it's relevant. Weren't you guys playing together in that band, both playing bass?
Well, that was a little bit later, but I remember when I was playing with Ira, we were playing more acoustic jazz standards, and Ira also had an electric band with Jaco, and that was with Jaco and Bobby Conamo, and Joe DiOrio was in that band, I think. I remember Ira would come in and say, you got to hear this bass player, Jaco, and he showed me one of his tunes, and I said, wow, it sounds great. And I was in Miami, and Jaco was up in Fort Lauderdale, so it was a little bit of space, so that I was more really centralized right in Miami. But finally, I did hear him because that group played at a place up in Fort Lauderdale, and that changed me and a lot of people as far as bass playing. But then, in addition to that, there was a band called Baker's Dozen, which was a big band that was players from the era, studio players, and there were actually three bass players. We didn't all play at the same time, although two of us did. It was Don Mast was the acoustic player. And then they brought me in to play electric on some of the parts because a great composer, Ron Miller, wrote music that required electric bass. So we'd play two basses with that. Since Ira Sullivan was playing with Jaco in another band, he brought Jaco in with some of Jaco's arrangements for big band that then Baker's Dozen played, and Jaco played them.
He sort of tailored the arrangement for the
Right, it
the
was
Baker's
things
Dozen.
That he had written for Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders, and he sort of tailored the horn section for that.
Wow.
So that was my first introduction to Jaco, and wow, amazing. We actually, it's kind of a funny story, but we got kicked out of a rehearsal. Did I tell you this?
No.
We rehearsed at Dade College, and Jaco and I were in the room, and the other bass player was playing acoustic bass, and Jaco and I were in the back of the auditorium, and Jaco said, man, you know, Jaco is very intense.
Uh-huh.
Some people may have known him or seen the recent movie that was out. But he would say, man, you got to hear this. And he had a tape. He brought a reel-to-reel, a Sony four-track machine. You know how heavy those
That's
are?
That's commitment
They're
right there.
They're big. It's a huge, it's like a little mini refrigerator. He brought that, and we had two big sets of headphones. And we were in the back, and I was listening to it, and it was blowing my mind. It sounded like nothing I'd ever heard. It sounded like John McLaughlin playing bass or something. Mm. That's how it was beyond me. And you know how it is sometimes when you have headphones on, you don't hear yourself, so you talk loud.
Right, yeah, scream.
We were talking really loud, and the director of the band, Vince DiMaggio, kicked us out of the auditorium. You guys, get out of here! They kicked us out. I said, oh, man, whatever. But anyway, that was the first time I saw Jaco, and we did play in that band, you know, simultaneously, but not together.
Was any of that stuff, has it ever been recorded? Was anything recorded? Is there anything out? Or,
you know, they would just be bootleg tapes, and I don't have any of it, but there are some recordings of that band. I think there's some with Jaco. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be great to hear you and Jaco play together on some.
Yeah, we played together with the Gil Evans Orchestra later on in New York, and we did some tours in Europe and Japan, or was it just Japan? I think it was Japan.
I remember I read that Bill Mikulski book, and I think it was you. You're in the book a lot, and I remember you were talking about what a strong force he was, not just like bass playing, but his whole attitude. You know, he could just make you think you could walk through a wall or something.
Yes.
I believe that was your quote.
That was my quote, yeah.
Yeah.
I did take some lessons with him one summer when he was teaching adjunctly at the University of Miami, just a summer class he had took private students. And I would spend an hour with him, and I would be supercharged for days because he was so inspiring, and he had so much together and was so energized that it really rubbed off. And it's like that sometimes when you're around people that are really inspiring. You know, you just you carry that vibe, that feeling from them, and I really felt it so strongly from him. So it was really great. And, you know, that was Jaco the early years before his big fame.
Mm-hmm.
And when he started to have him get imbalanced problems or bipolar things happening,
yeah,
with drugs and alcohol. So I knew Jaco early on. He was completely straight and bragged about it and would stand out in front of this club that they would play at in Florida with Ira in the breaks, and he'd come out and he'd say, "Man, I don't do anything. I don't need to take anything. You know, I'm high on life. This is, you know, I'm just here for the music." And, you know, He had such a strong sense of self, and he would say, "No one's playing what I'm doing. No one's doing this, you know." And it's just, you're not used to, it comes off as ego, heavy, mm-hmm. you know, heavy self-ego thing, but it was okay because it was true.
He could back it up, yeah.
He backed it up big time. Tapes of them playing where he played Freedom Jazz Dance and some other songs.
And Bobby was playing drums?
Bobby was
playing. I got to work with Bobby a couple times.
Oh, yeah?
He came down to New Orleans and recorded some songs, and he's a great guy.
Great guy, great drummer.
He told me some funny stories. I know we don't really have to go in a linear fashion here, you know, timeline-wise. When you left Miami, what brought you to New York? You just said, "This is where the scene's happening, I'm coming to New York," kind of thing? Or did you have a gig in place?
I actually had a gig. It was with Phyllis Hyman, singer, who we've been playing in Miami and had a very successful band with Hiram Bullock and Clifford Carter, a great drummer, Bill Bowker, who was a great friend, and we played together a lot in Florida. And but that was the band, and we came up for a two-week engagement to play at a place on the Upper West Side called Russ Brown's on 96th Street in Columbus, right there. And the gig kept getting extended. We were there for a month or 6 weeks, and I just decided I wanted to move to New York then, because I'm just going to stay here. I didn't have much other happening, but I knew that we would be playing together.
Yeah. And you just thought the pastures are greener than Miami.
Yeah, and then I had, because around that time, there was a club called Mikel's, which was down the street from there. And during our breaks playing with Phyllis, we'd run down and go to Mikel's, and Stuff would be playing.
Yeah.
You know, with Steve Gadd and
Cornell Dupree and
Richard T. And Gordon Edwards. And it was, we said, "Whoa, this is great." But we had one weekend off from that club. I drove straight through to Miami, 24 hours, whatever. Took a nap on the way. And then I put all my possessions out on the street. I didn't have much, but my bedding, I just couldn't take it with me. You know, silverware, it was all...
Yeah, replaceable stuff.
Yeah, it was just junk stuff. But I just put it on the street and then drove back. Down and back. And then we played that night.
Man, that is freedom and determination right there.
Just, and I, you know, I just, because I wanted...
And youth, you know, just...
Yeah, but, and then as it turns out, after about a month, the keyboard player Clifford and I and the drummer got a call to go out with the Pointer Sisters. So that was a really big decision because we had been with Phyllis and we were very loyal to her and her band.
Yeah.
And here we came to New York and we left after about 7 weeks to go with the Pointer Sisters and we left Phyllis and it was, I tell you, that was one of the most gut-wrenching, heartbreaking decisions I had to make because it really hurt her.
She was crushed.
She was crushed. She didn't have a band. She had to get a band together. But I felt like I wanted to branch out and it was a good opportunity to get on a national act.
Yeah.
You know, so we went out and we did a tour with them, but we only did one tour. It didn't work out. And so we came back, Clifford and Billy and I came back to New York and I was back in New York without any work or anything. And I had saved a little bit of money from Florida, but I was now in New York and I was saying to myself, okay, now what? And I just said, well, just went around and listened to people and tried to sit in and I listened a lot. I went places and just listened. I just wanted to see what was going on. Gradually met a lot of friends and started working. And I also said, okay, I don't have anything happening work-wise, but I want to study. So I studied with Dave Holland.
Wow.
Because he was always one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I was playing upright and electric at the same time. And so I started taking lessons with Dave, which was to be studying with someone like him was really... incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and then one thing led to another, and I started playing with David Sanborn, but before that I played with Diodato. You know, it's funny how gigs happen and things happen. The bass player, Jeff Berlin, had gotten a call from Diodato, who wrote 2001 Space Odyssey.
Wow.
People know that.
Yeah.
That funky version of it that was on CTI Records. Jeff couldn't do this tour that he was doing of Mexico. So he called me, Jeff called me, he said, give Diodato a call and tell him you're available. And I said, oh, I can't, he doesn't know, man, all these excuses. And I said, well, it can't hurt, let me try. So I called him up and he said, well, who you been playing with? I said, well, I just got off the road with the Pointer Sisters. He goes, great, hired, you want to go to Mexico for a month? You know, I didn't even ask how much it paid. I didn't care.
Yeah.
I was just so happy to be playing. I did that and things like that kept happening.
Yeah, snowballed from there.
Yep.
I'm fascinated with 70s and 80s New York. There obviously there's like way more going on, but it's weird the way gigs can sort of come out of some remote random connection. And,
right.
And sometimes a year or two later.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, you found that yourself?
I have. But it's interesting to hear that it's always been like that.
Yeah.
You know?
It just sort of pieces together and one thing leads to another. But one thing is you have to have it together.
Yeah.
When you got to play, you know, it's, you got to be. So that's why, you know, all the hard work in Miami and playing with all those different people, I had a lot of experience. And I also, when I was in Miami, something that gave me a lot of experience, there was a ton of work on Miami Beach at all the hotels. They had big bands, medium-sized bands, and every week a different act would come in and you'd play the act for the whole week. And so you'd have one rehearsal the day, first day of the gig. And so that's how I really cut my teeth on reading and, you know, urgent reading. Like, you got to make the gig tonight.
Plus you were a trumpet player and horn players are above and beyond better readers usually than guitar players or bass.
So I sort of applied the trumpet to the bass, so I was doing those gigs on bass at Miami Beach. And so, you know, there would be Bobby Rydell would come for a beat, and then Frankie Avalon, and then Bobby Vinton, all these South Philly mm-hmm. guys, and the Red Fox comedian. We'd play mm-hmm. him on, and we had a big band to play him on, and I actually went on the road with Red Fox. I toured with Red Fox, which was really a lot of fun.
Man, I met him when I was a kid in the French Quarter on Bourbon Street. I was probably 14, 15. I wasn't supposed to be out there. I was with my cousin, and I saw him in a gift shop with like his bodyguard or somebody. It was like midnight. And I used to watch Sanford Son every day after school, and I went up to him and asked him to sign a dollar. It's all I had.
Oh, jeez.
And he rejected me. He said, I love money too much. I can't sign that.
That's funny.
That's my Red Fox door. You know, I was looking at like your discography. You know, last time I was over here, we were talking about Duran Duran. I want to hear about all that stuff too, but I looked up your discography last night. Some of it I knew, but a lot of it I was surprised. I was like, speaking of unrelated gigs, you played on a Bill Cosby record.
Yes.
What is that?
Bill Cosby was...
Just to sidestep for a second. You know?
He was always doing different projects, but he wanted to go in the studio and just experiment. And he would go in and he'd get people together, so he got... One of the sessions was John Scofield, Jack DeJohnette, Harold Mayburn, and myself, and Harold Vick.
Wow.
And we were going to a studio over in Queens, where it was the same place where he shot his show, The Cosby Show.
Okay.
Kaufman Studios. Really nice studio. It was in the basement part of it. And he would come up with these little themes, and then we would improvise on them, and he would have me play sometimes 8-string fretless through a wah-wah pedal. There's a record of it.
It will be on this podcast.
I'm in there playing that with Jack DeJohnette and, you know, playing a blues, and it was great. We played on, it was a music show on VH1, I think, one of those video shows. Mm-hmm. We did a live show with Sonny Chirac on guitar.
Yeah, wow. That's out. Man.
Yeah, we did a lot of sessions. Chirac. There's a lot of tapes, a lot of hours and hours and hours, because we just rolled the tape. And he'd play a little percussion, but he was mostly in the room, like, pointing to people to play and, you know, give them a little direction, you know, okay, come on, more, you know, and then he'd have people lay out. And so he was more like conducting it.
I always heard he was a big jazz lover and aficionado of, you know, arts and things.
He is. I was sorry to hear what's going on with him.
Yeah, well.
But
I thought maybe it was a little bit of BS, but after 60 women come out, you know, it's kind of like...
You know, right.
I think one of them, the other day, I watched something on the news, and they disproved her whole account of what happened, and it's like, great, only 59 more to go.
I know.
You've worked with so many great guitar players, like you just mentioned John Scofield. I know you work with Hiram and Gil Evans Orchestra.
Yeah.
You work with John Abercrombie because you gave me his record, your record you did on your label, and I think you said he played through these amps here, and who else?
I've been so blessed to play
Steve
with
Kahn.
Steve Kahn.
And of course, Pat Metheny, which we should talk about, definitely.
Yeah, sure, Pat, and Pat Martino, and John McLaughlin.
The two Pats, and yeah, McLaughlin. Right, I forgot about McLaughlin.
I recorded with on a track with Bill Evans, did a couple of songs with John. Man. That was really peak highlight of my career, you know, to play with him.
And you know, it's funny, it's interesting you say Pat. Before we get into Metheny, the first time I met you was not through Steve Shapiro, it was in Vancouver.
That's
in the
right,
hotel.
With Pat Martino.
Pat Martino.
At the Vancouver
yes.
Jazz Fest.
I right? worked up the nerve to approach Pat Martino.
Awesome.
Because he's a pretty daunting looking cat, man.
He is.
And he had the sunglasses on, and I worked up the nerve to go up to him. And he sort of brushed me off for 10 seconds until I mentioned, yeah, I know your star, you know, the diminished chord thing.
And his eyes
I read up on it. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, what's your name?
Nice.
I didn't tell him I don't know how to use any of it, but I understand it.
Nice. You know?
And then we took a photo, and you were in the photo. And years later, I found it. And
that's classic. Yeah,
but
I remember that.
I read somewhere where when you were playing, when the Pat Metheny thing came together, and that first amazing band, that you guys played like 200 dates, 300 dates everywhere.
300 days a year for 4 years.
Wow. That's before you did the first record.
It was from the beginning of the band till when I left the band. That was about how many dates we did. But the first year before the record was out, we did probably that, not quite that many, but almost. But, you know, Pat, just to back up a little bit,
yeah.
I was at the University of Miami with Pat, as mm-hmm. well as Danny Gottlieb. Mm-hmm. So we were buddies from there. And then Pat moved to Berkeley in Boston to teach and play with Gary Burton. I still stayed in Miami, but then I came up in 76, and that was in 76 when I, later on, right after Diodato, David Sanborn asked me to join his band because Hiram was in the band. So Hiram got me on that band, and that was another big decision because I was playing with Diodato, but then I said, well, I got to play with the David Sanborn band. So bigger decision was when I was with David Sanborn, and we had just done a record for Warner Brothers, and he recorded one of my songs called Heart Lake, one of the first compositions that I got recorded.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Dave asked, do you have any songs? And I said, yeah. Wanted to see if I wanted to join the band with Lyle Mays and Danny and him. So, and Pat was unknown at the time. He was known because he had done Bright Side's Life,
mm-hmm.
his first record. He was known in the guitar world, but it wasn't, popular like the way it became.
Mm-hmm.
So, I went from David Sanborn's group, who was very popular. We were playing really big venues, to going on the road in a van and carrying our own equipment, setting up and going on. But what really sold me or made me want to do it was I went up to, Pat said, well, just come up and we'll rehearse one time. So I took a train up to Boston. I practiced all the way. I like trains for that, if you can
yeah,
get
the
good. Room.
Yeah, if they show up on time.
Yeah.
If you don't
and
miss
I,
them.
We played
like I did.
A couple of things from Watercolors and Bright Side's Life. And I said, I got to do this.
You just
this
clicked.
This is why
I
want to play creative music. Not that David Sanborn Band wasn't creative, but this was really original stuff. And I just said, I really had a strong feeling about it. So.
And you made two, I don't know offhand, out of my head, but what, Pat Metheny Group was the first one, then American Garage is like classic.
Yeah, and we did the soundtrack to a science movie, I forget what it was called. Search for Solutions, that was the soundtrack we did as well.
The balloons don't respond instantly. You have to see 30 seconds ahead, anticipate what you should do. Your decision had better be right. One balloon doesn't go faster than another. The same wind is available to everyone. Once you're up, set your course. You have to read both the earth and the sky.
Yesterday, the ponds had squirrels on top of them. The steam
but yeah, it was a great experience and a real growing period for me and for the group and everybody establishing a group sound. And, the band had a real identifiable sound, and we worked really hard on dynamics and flowing together as a group,
Yeah, those early records are so good. I love Pat Metheny. I don't know any guitar players that do not love Pat Metheny, but I got to say, man, the Secret Weapons, you and Lyle Mays in that band, that was a sound, man.
It was a sound, and the sound of Danny, and Danny plays with so much empathy, and so much, he's such a sensitive player, but also has a lot of force, and I hope we can play sometime with Danny. That would be great.
I would love to. You guys are like...
We're brothers.
Used him. You're basically a team. Yeah.
We're real brothers.
Pretty much anything you'd...
So we really got to grow as a rhythm section, for those 4 years, playing all the time. playing so much, and
it was great.
The first record, the white, sort of called the White Album, which is the Pat Metheny Group album, we did it in 2 days or some, only a few days. Mm-hmm. It was mostly first and second takes, mm-hmm. no overdubs, except for if Pat doubled something, like with his 12 string or his odd tune guitar, I think, and Lyle played the auto harp on it, some things, but otherwise it was live.
And that's the upside of doing 300 dates a year, is you can go in the studio
and just
blow it out.
We played the set down.
Yeah.
Played the set down. And it was recorded by Manfred Eicher from ECM Records, and Jan Erik was the engineer.
Did you do it in Oslo, in that famous studio?
Yep. We did it in Oslo at Tone Studio. I think that's the name of it.
So that console has got to be a big part of that sound, huh?
Yes, and you know, I think it was a Neve console, I'm pretty sure. And on my bass, I had an Ampeg B15 with an RE20 mic on it. I was playing a Fender 58 Precision that used to belong to Pat, and then he gave it to Jocko, and Jocko gave it to me.
So it's sort of a strange lineage there.
Tech guy had made it into a fretless. That's how I really started getting into fretless, was at that point, because... And I remember we were playing at Paul's Mall up in Boston, which is a jazz club that used to be in Boston. And the bass was ready, and Jocko sent it. At that time, I was on Eastern Airlines. It showed up at the airport, so I had to drive that afternoon to the airport. And I wish I still had the note that Jocko put a note. It was in an Anvil case, and I played the bass that night. But he goes, I think he said something like, "Here you go, Eags. You know, it's playing really great, you know." So, and then I just played it that night, and that was it. I never played fretted in that band again. It was always fretless.
It's a very expressive sound. Maybe you being a trumpet player kind of picked up on that some kind of way innately or something. You know?
I think so, yeah. I had the melodic head, yeah. You know, from playing, because I used to play jazz on trumpet. I mean, I was aspiring to... And listening to people like Miles Davis and Kenny Dorham and Clifford Brown and Freddie Hubbard, that's what my head was, you know.
Well, that's, you know, like, just to get into more your bass playing now, I mean, you're a very melodic player. The stuff I've heard you do and a few times we played together, I always pick up on that. And now it sort of makes sense. The trumpet is probably where that melodic foundation came from, the way you shape lines or the way you hear things, maybe, right?
I think definitely.
I mean, you can definitely funk and play all that, you know, foundational type bass stuff, but I hear the melodic, the shape of the contour, the lines and
yeah,
things.
Yeah, I think, you know, the trumpet is still in me, you know, it's still in my spirit. It's just when you do something in your youth, you know, it never really leaves you. It's a part of you, you know, it's just a way of thinking, and from playing in all those jazz bands and practicing for, you know, you have to, with trumpet, you have to put a lot of time in, with any instrument. I think
yeah,
a lot
to
of
get the intonation and things too, the embouchure, but also fretless is a pretty hard axe to get the intonation dead on too. I mean, that's a lot of
it is, and it's something I use, as you can see here, I got my bass inlays for fret markers, and I mm-hmm. rely on those all the time. Mm-hmm. Look at them.
Yeah, that's a beautiful... You've been playing those Padulas for a long time, right?
Long time, since 1981. And I've been working with him since then, and this is the latest version, which is actually a signature bass that he did for me. It has little different things. It's more of a cutaway, which means my left hand on the strings goes... I can go to the 24th fret. It has a little bit of different electronics on it, and the neck is a little narrower from front to back. So I don't have big hands, so that really helps. You know, another thing from playing trumpet, and I was trying to be an improviser, learning improvisation was the theory of improvising, and there was a transitional period when I was at Miami where, it's a funny story, but I've shared this house in Miami with a trumpet player and a saxophone player, and I had my bass amp there, and the trumpet player had a drum set of drums, and we used to just jam, just play around. One day, this guy who, another saxophone player, came to visit. His name is Jet Nero. Great name.
Jet Nero.
He's a saxophone player. I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he was in Miami, and he's one of those guys. He didn't go to the university, but he was always playing gigs. He was always playing in clubs, and he always had a band, and he just always worked. He came over and he saw that there was a bass amp there and he needed a bass player the next night. So he called and said, "Who plays bass there?" And my friend Randy said, "Mark does." And so I talked to Jet. He goes, "You want to play tomorrow night?" And I had never played a gig on bass, really. And I said, "Okay." I had balls.
Yeah.
You know, I just said, "What?" And so I got all the lead sheets and I learned it and I played one finger bass on the left hand and the right hand.
Some people make a lot of money still playing one finger bass. You know?
Yeah, well, it was like two finger bass. And so I did the gig. I was kind of petrified, but I locked in and we had a good time. And he said, "Do you want to join the group?"
Wow.
And I thought I was an imposter. I said to myself, "Wow." I said, "Yeah, sure." I was really a trumpet player. It was more of a secondary instrument for me. And then I started playing. I started transferring a lot of the information that I had learned on trumpet and the theory and harmony to the bass, and I realized, wow, I got a lot to catch up on. That's how I changed
the transition.
So
I think you made the right decision.
Yeah, I loved it. I just wanted to play all the time, and I played all the time. I'd go to these loft sessions around New York and Brooklyn area, and people would want to play, you know, let's play this tune or that tune. And I always wanted to just, you know, find out what the free music or what the music that we could create in the moment was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of that in Florida, a lot of experimental music.
I love that stuff, man.
Yeah.
Maybe we should play something now.
Mm.
Yeah, why don't you just start something, Mark, and I'll see if something comes up. Elements come together. I know that was post Athene and stuff, but that was your group.
Yeah,
with Danny,
co-led by Danny and I. Yeah,
you had a lot of other people involved. I mean, you did like 15 records or something.
A lot of records, yeah. You know, we had Danny and I have a special rapport, and we had talked about doing a project after I left the Matheny group, and I had been starting to do a lot of studio work in the early 80s, 1980-81, and I had played at this studio called Howard Schwartz Recording, which was above Grand Central Station in the Gray Bar building.
They had a studio above Grand Central?
Three floors, yeah. A lot of commercials were done there, but he had a great Studio West was one of the rooms there, and it had at that time it was an MCI board, and it just sounded good. The room sounded great, but I had been working there, and I met the engineer, Richard Brownstein, who later has become a great friend and engineered most of my records. And he said, you know, if you guys ever want to do anything on the weekends, you know, I can get in, Howard will get me in, we could do. So I talked to Dan, I said, we got to do something. And then we came up with some concepts and ideas, and I had written a few songs, more songs. So we wrote for that, and we also had special guest Clifford Carter playing keyboards. Some of you might know Clifford from, played with James Taylor, Brian Ferry.
Yeah.
He's just, Clifford's a incredible musician, and at that time we had been made new friends with Bill Evans, who was playing with Miles Davis at the time, so we had Bill play on it. So that was the quartet for that first record that was on Island Records. You know, the concept for Elements was we wanted to create a backdrop that would feature Danny and I, our rapport as drums and bass, but also to play some creative music inspired by like Weather Report and sort of that direction. So it wasn't really fusion, but I guess nowadays people would probably call it more fusion. It was instrumental, contemporary jazz.
I mean, I think in Japan you guys were really known, right? They would use a lot of your music on TV and things.
Exactly. And we did a live recording in Japan, and that's how I started my record label, Wavetone Records, because we had those tapes that we recorded, and when we recorded it, they had a remote truck that came, and part of the contract that we wrote for this, that was written, and we had to sign to do this, it was for a live radio broadcast, but when they came backstage with the contract to sign, I added a clause in it that says, we own these masters and can put them out worldwide and everything. And so we got the masters, and that's nice. Sort of how I started my label.
Ah, I didn't know that. That answers another question. What gave you the idea to start your label, Wavetone?
So, yep, and so that was, we had a week's worth of records, so I put out 3 volumes of that.
Wow.
And then started to...
Here's your aunt, see, sputtering.
Oh, that's the tube.
It could be a two, I'm not sure, but...
So then we put that out, and then I re-released some of my records that I had licensed to other companies. I did a record on Windham Hill called Mosaic. It was my first solo record. That was one of them that I brought out because it was a 5-year lease. So I got the rights back, which I'm glad I did it. I got some good advice along the way about working with record companies and... So then it snowballed, and one thing led to another. I have worldwide distribution for my label in Europe and in Japan and in the States.
Wavetone,
yep. Now we have 25 releases out. But Elements is Danny and my playground, basically, for writing, because I really like to compose for that band.
If you had to pick a couple of your favorite tracks from 15 records,
whoa!
I mean, just give me like a 2 or 3 that you just come to mind right off.
Of the Elements records, I love the first Elements record. There's a tune called Electric Fields that I really like. There's another one called Color Wheel. It was very spacious.
You know, another thing, just to sidestep again, a lot of people don't know that you played on that Joan Osborne, the record called Relish, which in mid-90s had the big hit, What If God Was One of Us?
Yes.
You were on that whole record. I remember looking at the record going, wow, Mark Egan's on this record.
Yeah.
And you said it was recorded...
it was in Katona. Yep. The producer, Rick Chertoff, wanted to get it out of the city, and he rented a house on a reservoir there, which we passed by all the time.
Reservoir, sure. When I was living up there, I used to walk there all the time.
And we spent 5 days a week for a month. We would just be there 5 days, and I'd be home on weekends. So it was perfect. It was great. And we just did all the tracks there. And I had worked with him before on the Sophie B. Hawkins record. Mm-hmm. That's another track that I really like. It's Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover.
Oh, yeah.
And
I didn't know you played on that.
Yeah. And
wow.
And
it's very cool.
It's so funny because we went to New Orleans to play at a record convention that was on Sony, I think. So they flew us down there to play with that band. And it's so funny because the head of Sony came to the rehearsal studio, you know, and while we were doing it, we were playing that song. And he came up to me, he goes, "Now I want you to play it, you know, like the guy that played it on the record, you know." And I said, "No, it.
Yeah,
I wrote it. No, I, you know, I played on it." It was funny. It was, anyway. But yeah, that was. So I worked with Rick Chertoff, the producer on that. That's when I first met him. He was doing this Joan Osborne project. But it was it was Rick Chertoff and Eric Bazillion, who's a guitar player who plays with a group called the Hooters, and Rob Hyman. They're like a team. They worked on Cyndi Lauper's first record, and then they called me in for that record with Sophie B. Hawkins, and then the Joan Osborne.
Kind of funny because we were talking about Maria Muldaur, and it's like the guitar player wrote the biggest hit on her record, and the Midnight at the Oasis, Maria Muldaur, and then Joan Osborne, if I remember correctly, she didn't write that song.
No, it was written by Eric Bazillion,
who's the guitar player.
Yes.
See, it takes a guitar player, man.
It takes a guitar.
No, I'm just joking. It's just an interesting name.
Yes.
But how did the Duran Duran connection came? Because you've done, you have a good relationship with those guys, right? You've played bass on a few, not just one record, a couple of records. Right?
Just the one record, which was called Arcadia. So Red the Rose is the name of the record. If I spin back a little bit, in my Miami days, we used to also go to Criteria Studios and record at night because the engineer, who was an assistant engineer, his name is Alex Sadkin, was at Criteria, and he would let us come in and do these late night recordings for free because he just wanted to record and do things. And so we were going with our band with Phyllis Hyman, without Phyllis, just the rhythm section with Hiram, Clifford, myself, and Bill Bowker. And we would do these all-night recording sessions. So Alex Sadkin, I stayed in touch with him. He later became a major engineer and producer. He did, I think he recorded Bob Marley. He did Simply Red. Mm-hmm. He recorded all the Duran Duran records. So I was doing some studio work in New York at Right Track Studios, which I don't know if it's there anymore, but probably not. I was in one studio recording, I think it was an Elements record, and Alex was in the other room recording Foreigner, that amazing hit. I want to know what love is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Tell me to know. Yeah. And so he was doing that. We met out in the hallway, and I said, "Alex, how's it going? Good, you know, great to see you." And funny thing is, he played baritone sax with Jaco in Miami, because he's from Fort Lauderdale. And so he was in the horn section with Las Olas Brass. So he knew Jaco, you know. So he knew that I was playing a lot. I was doing a lot of session work in New York. And he said, "Would you be interested? I might have a project that I might think to get you on. It's with the guys from Duran Duran." I said, "Great, I'd love to."
Mm-hmm. So that was a connection.
That was a connection. And so he hooked me up with them. And then maybe a month or two later, I was in Paris for 6 weeks recording with them. You know, I don't even think my name is on the record anymore, but it is me.
Yeah, your name was on the check. I'm sure it was a nice check.
The name was on the check, on the many checks, yes.
And there you go, folks.
It was very creative. Record and time period. We experimented
Love Duran
crazy with that record because they wanted to, David Gilmour played guitar on it. Mm. Sting was on some of it singing. Manu Kashe played percussion on it. Steve Jordan, who I recommended to Alex for drummers, Steve Jordan played on it, as well as Roger Taylor, the drummer that plays with Duran Duran, and Roger ended up playing on a lot of it. And we just experimented every day. For
those are dream sessions that probably don't exist anymore. Was that the same connection for Sting? Because you know, I forgot about Sting. He played on the Little Wing version.
Nothing Hiram, Like the Sun,
And Hiram played the solo, Hiram Bullock.
Yes, that was a little different because when I used to play with the Gil Evans Orchestra, which was also another iconic band for me to play in. And we used to play at Sweet Basil, which was a club in New York City on Bleecker Street at 7th Avenue. And we was a lot of people would come in to hear us, and Sting used to come in. And he used to sit in and sing. So that's how he met. And then they wanted to do a project together with Gil Evans Orchestra. So that's how that came about. And we recorded not only Little Wing, but we recorded Up From the Skies, which is a B single, you know, and it was released in Japan only. And it's a great track. Talk to you. Think about the 11th, it's like 12 horns or something. And every song, there's many soloists, so you got to have dynamics and let them build and really support the soloist. So it's a great lesson in, you know, changing it up and playing with different soloists and coming up with background parts, because Gil gave us the freedom to do whatever we wanted anytime. And that was the prerequisite that he set up. Sometimes when you have that much freedom, it can fall on its face and be complete chaos, but I think you get real brilliance out of that, because you're left to really, you know, on your own device. It gives you confidence to really do what you want to do, you know?
Yeah. I'm getting inspired just talking about this stuff now.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, as far as your solo projects, I know I was listening to one Beyond Words on the way up here, the one you gave me. You gave me a lot of music that day. That's beautiful, man. And there's a lot of Clifford Carter's on it.
Clifford Danny's on some.
Yeah, and who's the percussionist? The kind Don of crazy Elias. Guy from, you know, the other guy that was in Weather
Manolo Bedrinas. Yes. And there's a track on there with Don Elias that I really love on Beyond Words. I play harmonics and bass.
Yeah, I have it right
here. Oh, it's called Southeast Passage.
Oh, okay.
And the Southeast Passage refers to Miami. Is where my passage into music. That's what the title came. It's a very esoteric title, but Southeast Passage. And that was just bass and percussion. And I overdubbed a little synthesizer things and played a melody over it. But I used an Eventide harmonizer with a backwards setting. So whatever I played in came out backwards.
Yeah. Oh, you know, you were telling me too that you studied with, you went and took a lesson with Joe DiOrio.
Yes.
Just to get some new things to work on.
And yes.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know, Joe DiOrio is a sort of Yoda kind of guitar teacher who, I think he wasn't even Matheny's teacher and a couple other people. University of Miami connection.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. He wasn't actually at the university, but he was around there.
When I was at GIT, he sort of shut the door. He would never let us see.
Oh, wow.
We were so scared anyway. I'm not sure I would have knocked on the door. You know, pretty intimidating.
Yeah, cat. Joe was just one of those guys who was always inspired and always real serious musician.
Yeah.
He didn't mess around. He was always going for it. I admire that so much. You know, he didn't do a lot of commercial gigs he just always played creative music his whole life, you know. So I got together with him last year, just took one lesson. It was really, we just spent 5 hours. I thought it was going to be an hour. We spent 5 hours and a dinner. And he just laid so much on me. I just couldn't, it's so much to digest. But I wanted to get more, you know, to talk music, like when you're playing over a dominant seventh chord, I wanted to get some different ideas, and he approached it like Bartok. It's expanded. It's so mind-expanding. You know, I realized, and I wrote out a lot of the ideas, and it's really, it opened up a lot of things for me.
Like 12-tone row kind of things, something on over it?
Yeah, 12-tone and a lot of things that go outside and inside the tonal center, and ways of weaving in and out of that and making it melodic in a way, and just thinking of it differently. So it was good. Because, you know, as bass players, a lot, even though I play melodic and solos and stuff, we're always playing the groove, and you're stuck in, not stuck, but I'm focused on playing the ground, the foundation.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, like guitar players, you guys, you're focused on, you want to play around it all, you know, even though you're playing the groove and, you know, but it's with a bass player, it's hard to get outside of playing the foundation sometime if you do that a lot. So it's always good to get another perspective.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. So yeah, Mark, thank you so much again for doing this and sharing all of your experience and knowledge and all the cool stories and taking time to do it.
Yeah. Thank you, Shane. It's an honor and pleasure to do it. It's great.
Hopefully you had fun.
I had a blast. Thanks.
All right. All right, well, there you have it, folks. Mark Egan. A lot of fun to do that one. I hope you really enjoyed that one. Stay tuned next time for more episodes coming up. As always, love hearing from you. Thanks for listening to The Riff Raff.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.